So, firstly, let's just look again at yesterday's handout, The Structure of Experience, if you have it. It's just a list of the 12 nidanas. You'll see that with feeling as condition, says the Buddha, arises craving. So we've just each given an example of a certain sort of Vedana. And I think under retreat conditions, things seem to get a bit easier. So perhaps craving is eased, calmed to some degree. We're not under the usual pressures. But nevertheless, I'm sure you can imagine, even here, certain feelings prompting a response. Now, we discussed how craving, this word craving, translates tanha, wanting or longing. So what kind of things do we mean? So here's some ideas for you to consider how in our ordinary experience Vedana becomes, moves into forms of wanting. So the Buddha said there's three kinds of wanting, of tanha. Firstly, there's what he called tanha, wanting for sense experience. So if I put wanting sense experience, that's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Sure you could imagine. With a certain degree of positive Vedana towards a sense experience, the thought arises, I'd like some more of that. Yeah? I'd like a bit more. Or, in fact, it could be the opposite, that a little bit of negative Vedana produces an aversion. Oh, I really don't want that. Sal was being very mindfully equanimous about her wet socks. But she could have thought, ah, oh, wet socks, they are the worst. Yeah? There's nothing worse than wet socks. And really had an aversive reaction to her wet socks, for instance. That's quite obvious, but it's the other two, the next two, that where things get interesting. The Buddha says there's bhava tanha, wanting or craving for existence. Now, what this means is wanting or longing a kind of definite existence as a self. If we use the word narcissism, this brings us into a nice relationship with psychological theories. Narcissism's quite natural, as it were. It can get unhealthy and difficult, but narcissism mean, you might have heard of the myth of Narcissus. Coming across a pool in the woods, he leant over and saw a beautiful form. And became so entranced, he fell in love with this beautiful form. And looking and looking, he in this state of love and passion, he fell in and drowned. The end. Pardon?
Usual charming
Charming, charming story from the ancient Greeks. So, I'm not saying we're all quite so far gone in our self-love, but it might be worth thinking about how Vedana leads to narcissism, to wanting to be someone. I certainly know when I was younger, I had a very all sorts of ambitions to be a certain sort of successful philosopher, publish books, all this kind of thing. But the reality of our experience is that at any given moment, it's just this, yeah? Even if one achieves quite a lot that one wanted to achieve, in the moment, what you've got is your sense experience, your Vedana, whatever qualities you've cultivated. You're never going to actually experience the ideal person who you want to be. Does that make sense? of course, you might actually realise some of those good qualities that you fantasised about. But once you get there, say you start fantasising about being a Buddha. Great fantasy, huh? I could be the most enlightened Buddha. I think, not all Buddhists work like this, but say you did. That's going to be a very positive kind of fantasy, isn't it? And who knows, you may develop lots of really good qualities. But you'll never exactly experience being a Buddha, as it were. You'll experience just this conditioned process. Vedana, craving, and so on. The other side of the coin, then, is vibhava tanha, the craving or wanting oblivion or non-being. Since narcissism is in itself a strategy which is can lead to a sense of failure, we can translate that failure into a desire simply not to exist like this anymore. I don't want to be this kind of person. What an idiot. What a waste of space. And this is wanting oblivion, wanting non-existence. In a way, it's another kind of narcissism, I suppose, but in this case, directed against oneself. A really nice interpretation of this comes from Anālayo, a bhikkhu who's written a fantastic book on Satipatthana. In a different book, he made the point that we can also think of vibhava tanha in terms of the desire to attain a mystical union with God or the ground of being or the ultimate reality. Yeah? And I think this is useful because it gives us a sense of why the Buddha would have used this phrase. It can be very attractive to suppose that, if only in meditation I could disappear, I could blend with the universe, I could become one with the reality, you wouldn't have any problems anymore. Yeah? They'd be gone. So that's an understandable kind of fantasy again. I think you can. It seems to be emotionally entirely different from wanting oblivion. So I'm just suggesting these are different interpretations. It's not quite clear what the Buddha meant by vibhava tanha.
I often think of bhava tanha as to do with ambition.
Ambition, yeah.
So like projecting forwards of what I want to be or do.
Yeah, yeah. I guess ambition would be like, ambition as a translation of bhava tanha, would be like a paradigm example of how we want to exist. We're ambitious to become a CEO, a director of a retreat centre. He laughs. So in these cases, the life of Vedana translates into definite forms, doesn't it? Definite forms of wanting. This is how it goes. Put like this, it doesn't look exactly bad, does it? I don't think the Buddha's necessarily saying craving is bad. But nevertheless, he's suggesting that our pervasive dukkha arises based on our identification with trying to sort out, fix our Vedana in certain ways, either by getting more of it, becoming a certain person, having these ambitions, or in fact wanting not to be anything. And on the story goes, on condition of craving arises clinging, upadana. This used to be translated attachment, often is, I suppose. But I find that this word attachment in English is quite ambivalent. You know, it's used very positively, isn't it, in psychotherapy. You need to develop attachments in order to become a healthy human being. And I suspect that's true, even as, you know, serious Buddhists, we're going to be attached to certain friends, family members, and so on. Even the Buddha was said to be attached to his friends, certainly attached to Ananda, in that positive sense of having a healthy emotional relationship. So perhaps, in my view, we don't need to think about getting rid of our attachments. Rather, what's being referred to is grasping or holding on. As in, converting our wanting and longing into fixed ways of trying to fix, fixed ways of trying to make our life work. There's said to be four kinds of upadana, holding on. Holding on to sense pleasures, holding on to views, holding on to rites and rituals, and holding on to theories about the self. So most of these, three of these, views and rites and rituals and theories of the self, are about how we relate to our experience. And I think that makes a certain sense, holding on to sense experiences, sense pleasures, as it were, is only kind of one, a starting point for how we hold on, we grasp our experience. With clinging as tradition, as condition, it says that now arises bhava, or becoming, or existence. We've already come across this word, haven't we, in terms of wanting this bhava. So now it looks like we get it. The Buddha says that bhava means existence in the realm of sense experience, or in the realm of pure form, which I guess means the god realms, or the realm of no form, which is something very rarefied. Not entirely sure what that means. And with existence as condition arises birth. With birth as condition arises aging and death. There's two ways of looking at these final links of the nidanas. The first one is that they denote what will happen in the future with craving and clinging as conditions. That there may be there's going to be future existence, future birth, future aging and death, which means the continuation of samsara, the round of existence. Makes sense, doesn't it? In the Buddhist traditional context, this is how rebirth works. Another way of looking at it is that existence and birth and aging and death are, as it were, the ultimate human illusions. It seems as though we exist as me, as this kind of being, with these definite qualities. It seems as though this being was born on the 9th of December 1965, out emerged into the world, Stephen Thomas Jones. It seems as though this very being, at some point, will get old and die. But all that is true while there is holding on to the process of conditions, which is presently, I call Stephen Thomas Jones. This is like the slightly mystical way of looking at Patichisamupada, but there's some evidence for this, I think, in how the Buddha talks about the sage at peace, who is unborn, who's no longer born, doesn't suffer, is not prone to get old, and doesn't die. So the sage at peace is described as one who is unborn, undying, not liable to aging. Now, what do we make of that? It sounds good, I suggest there's a reference to the way consciousness and the mind can be entirely freed, liberated through spiritual practice, freed even from being pinned down, as it were, to a definite existence as such and such, such that birth happens to the body, but it's not necessarily the whole story of what this person now is. Aging and death, of course, is everyone's destiny. But it's the truth of the organism, not necessarily of the mind, the process of mental events, who exists on condition of that organism. So I've gone through all the links of the 12 Nidanas now. Blimey. And what I'd like to do now is go back a bit and look at a bit more of the structure of really ordinary experience to see how the Buddha describes that arising. We talked yesterday about sankhara, the formations, the volitional tendencies that act like ruts and grooves, guiding our experience down familiar patterns. These sankharas can be formations that come from our childhood, perhaps from past karma, perhaps from past lives. And they're both things that we experience in the sense that they form us, but they're things that we contribute to as well. To the degree that we join in with our own tendencies, they get reinforced and they continue. To the degree that we notice them but make the effort to stand back, to retain some awareness, sankharas can change, can diminish. Otherwise, there's no point in the spiritual life, really, if we couldn't actually change our deep tendencies. I'm not saying it's easy. In our group yesterday, we had some examples of how people experience themselves as having changed certain tendencies they've had. I'm sure one way or another you've all had some experience of that. So there's another way we can think about these formations, how our experience gets affected right in the moment. And this comes from the way we experience Vedana. So I don't know if you've got the handout called Two Discourses on Feelings and Our Reactions to Them. It has the Arrow Sutta on it. I should have said, bring your old handouts, but I can just read it out. Here's another extract. The Arrow Sutta is very interesting. The idea of the second arrow of emotional or mental Vedana is really a vivid kind of a metaphor or image to illustrate how Vedana can get compounded, how just the first physical Vedana can get compounded by our mental reactions. But it only really works for negative Vedanas, or the Buddha only describes painful Vedanas. So what's the overall picture? It's more complicated. And this comes out in this extract from a discourse called Six Sets of Six. Really exciting title, isn't it? Six Sets of Six. We studied it last year, didn't we? And the problem is, it's incredibly repetitive. And you have to work hard to draw out the meaning. So we've had an easier time this year. But here's the exciting bit from it. Someone, being touched by a pleasant feeling, delights in it, rejoices about it, and is welcoming towards it. For such a person, the underlying tendency to compulsion underlies it. So someone experiences a pleasant feeling. That pleasant feeling then becomes the starting point for delighting, rejoicing and welcoming, because an underlying tendency to compulsion accompanies the pleasant feeling. Yeah? It's like an amplifier, I suppose, you could say. Someone who, being touched by an unpleasant feeling, painful feeling, grieves, is distressed and upset, beats their breast and gets bewildered. For such a person, the underlying tendency to aversion underlies it. So here the amplifying effect is the opposite. Someone experiences an unpleasant feeling, painful feeling, and a tendency to push away kicks in. Someone, this is the final option, who, being touched by a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, does not comprehend as it really is its arising and passing away, its appeal, the problem with it, and the escape from it. For such a person, the underlying tendency to ignorance underlies it. That's a bit more complicated, isn't it? I was saying earlier that we are actually continually, relentlessly experiencing Vedana, but actually most of it is fairly neutral, I imagine. Thank goodness. And because of that, the Buddha's suggesting, it's not so much there's an amplifying effect here, but our tendency is there's an underlying tendency to ignorance in relation to them. We don't take any notice of neutral Vedana. In fact, we just ignore them entirely because of the underlying tendency to ignorance. Ignorance being, in this sense, a kind of active force keeping us going in whatever fantasies about becoming an ambitious, you know, ambitious fantasies we're involved in. So rather than taking note of neutral Vedana, thinking, neutral Vedana, there's just nothing happening. One's not aware. The Buddha concludes, therefore, monks, not abandoning the underlying tendency to passion towards a pleasant feeling, not dispelling the underlying tendency to aversion towards an unpleasant feeling, not abolishing the underlying tendency to ignorance towards a neither pleasant nor unpleasant feeling, that such a person, not abandoning ignorance and not giving rise to clarity, which means knowledge, would make an end of all pain or dukkha right now, this is not possible. Damn, eh? What a pity. Just by drifting on, blindly not noticing our Vedana, it's not possible to put an end to dukkha. It's quite a complicated little extract, this, isn't it? The Buddha packs things in. The Pali grammar, syntax, is really tangled. So I've tried to clear it up as much as possible here. So on the handout from yesterday, you'll see I've illustrated this whole business. With some extra links. So in the 12 Nidanas, we're familiar with the idea that with feeling as condition arises craving. It now looks like craving for sense pleasures, for to exist as a particular someone or to not exist. Actually, that process psychologically is the product, or what that process consists of, is some underlying tendencies getting kicked off by certain feelings. So underlying tendencies to compulsion, aversion, or ignorance. What do you think about these underlying tendencies? Do you think that can you relate to the idea of these? Are they things you have experienced one way or another? All the time, says Yasha Bodhi. So that's yes. Sometimes I find it extraordinary that under certain circumstances I can have quite a compulsive tendency. I've talked about this a lot in the past. The late night movie watching Sankara. Yeah, that's my thing. Late night movie watching Sankara. I've nearly cracked it, by the way, which I'm very pleased about. It's taken a lot of work. When I used to be sort of rather busy and stressed and having a lot to do, late at night I can think, the best thing to do now is watch a really violent sci-fi movie. Yeah?
Alien versus Predator.
For instance, Alien versus Predator. Now, Prometheus, yes. As we talked earlier, I've watched both of those. Prometheus several times. Steve has watched Alien vs. Predator, so I don't know what it says about his late night movie watching habits, but maybe nothing. But yeah, they're examples of when these things happen. It's an extraordinary compulsive tendency that I've noticed, which always makes me feel worse. Yeah, but at the time I think that's what makes me feel better. Strange, isn't it? It's obviously based on a complete misapprehension. Part of me has completely the wrong idea about what will help, but part of me believes it as well. And later I think that didn't help at all. What did I believe? And I can feel my way into it, but by then it's too late, as it were. And I used to get into a lot of, you know, complicated self-blame and regret and all that. But gradually I got very interested. Yeah, and who's that kind of boy really who thinks that's a really sensible, really the thing to do? And you know, it turns out that we've been able to get into a sort of dialogue, I suppose, over the years, and come to some more sensible ways of looking at what to do when the going gets tough. Reading sci-fi novels is much better because it's much less stimulating. So, I mean, you're going to have your own stories about your underlying tendencies. So partly they're personal. The one I just talked about is completely personal, yeah? Although I imagine not entirely unusual. You're going to have your own stories. But do you think these tendencies have a sort of deeper origin as well? I think in the Buddhist tradition, it's been very straightforward to say that these tendencies are the results of past karma. Yeah, this is what we mean by past karma. You know, the unskillful actions of previous life or earlier in this life result in the accumulation of underlying tendencies of this kind of unwholesome sort. I think that's, you know, that's not the worst explanation in the world. It's also possible these days to think about these underlying tendencies in terms of evolutionary psychology, if that's the explanatory model that works better for you. That the evolution of human beings through hundreds of thousands or millions of years has favoured certain kinds of tendencies of behaviour. For instance, compulsive chasing of sense pleasures, yeah, might actually have some evolutionary advantage. Who gets there first, who's most keen, is going to get the food and sex. That's going to mean it's going to give you a reproductive advantage. Doesn't mean it's sensible or bright or anything else, but it's what's going to it's how natural selection works. I'm not an evolutionary psychologist, so that's only like a mention. But this is one way to look at the underlying tendencies. We don't need to take them too personally. Nevertheless, Buddhism is a kind of rebellion against natural selection in a certain way, which is the same thing as to say it's the attempt to overcome past karma. Yeah, using a completely different paradigm of knowledge. So in either case, we've got a pretty big task, and that's what we start to do in our ethical practice, in our meditation, in our study and reflection, to notice underlying tendencies which create patterns of habitual behaviour and start to feel into them, find ways to let go. In that way, the link between feeling and craving starts to become less strong, less compelling. So our model here becomes a useful one to show us exactly what we're trying to do in our Buddhist practice. We're always left, of course, with Vedana. This is important, isn't it? We're always going to be left with our Vedana. Although it's interesting to note that, you know, in conditions of retreat, our Vedana is often quite pleasant and positive. We don't perhaps feel quite the need to convert that Vedana into anything else. And perhaps that's also an important part of Buddhist practice, finding resources, positive Vedana, so one can live in the moment. Now I can move on to today's topic. Well, that was today's topic, but I've got some more today's topic. Today we get onto the topic of proliferation. You might be beginning to think, well, this is an incredibly abstract model of experience. And in some ways it is. In some ways, it might be better to see it not as an abstract theory. It's not supposed to be like that at all. The idea is that it's a model. And I've got all these ideas from the Pali Canon. None of them are mine. It's a model that the Buddha taught. Although, of course, we don't know exactly if it's come down to us as clearly as the Buddha taught it. I imagine the Buddha was much clearer than I am, and much clearer than is represented in the Pali Canon. But it's a model of how experience works, which is supposed to be useful. To the extent that it's part of the Dharma, it's useful for the task of working on ourselves. So we've got a really fantastically complicated looking diagram here. But actually, it doesn't get any more complicated than this. Wouldn't you think that, you know, given that we're all in a situation of samsara, of experiencing dukkha, so much dukkha that you've come up here on retreat, yeah, one way or another, that the situation's not going to be absolutely simple, is it? There's going to be some complexity going on that you haven't noticed. And this is it. This is the complex picture that, if only you knew it, you'd understand what's going on. So with that in mind, I hope, even if it feels difficult or abstract, you might think this is worth getting some handle on. Could be, yeah. This is yes, the tanha for understanding paticchasamuppada. Yeah. I have that. So I'm basing this business of talking about proliferation on a very interesting discourse called the Honeyball Discourse, the Madhupindika. And in this discourse, the Buddha takes our by now familiar psychological model of experience, starting from the sense organs, the sense spheres, and consciousness, moving to contact and feeling. And he then moves on from feeling to show another direction of development of our experience. And this one is what happens in the mind, what happens in our thinking. So we just heard about the underlying tendencies to compulsion, aversion, to ignorance. And these underlying tendencies are, as it were, the emotional or evolutionary, really not very intellectual kind of responses that happen to our Vedana. You can't really argue with a compulsive tendency, if you see what I mean. You have to get into a more gutsy kind of relationship. But, human beings are characterized by our big brains. And what our big brains do is what the Buddha calls proliferate. So this word proliferation, it's a funny word in English, isn't it? I don't know if it's part of your active vocabularies. I've been in touch with someone in Estonia who translates, Buddhist Bodhicara. He's an order member in Estonia. And he's been really wondering how to translate proliferation because they don't quite have the word in Estonian. And got me trying to say, well, what does it mean in English? But that's quite a challenge. In some ways, it's a very useful word in as much as it translates a Pali word. And that really should be what we're focusing on, because that's what we're getting at. So the word is papancha, which you can see there's this reduplication. There's this doubling of the first syllable, pa. And that gives the sense of intensifying the meaning of pancha. So really, it means something like spreading out. And it's a word that's used in the Upanishads, which are older than the Pali canon and are a kind of our only pre-Buddhist literature about philosophy. They give us a sense that in before the Buddhist time, or maybe during the Buddhist time, the word papancha was used to describe the spreading out, the evolution, the manifestation of the universe. So if you imagine everything started from a single principle, let's call it Brahman in the Upanishads, and then it evolved into all the myriad things in this Indian cosmology, that process is one of papancha. Spreading out, manifestation. But the Buddha, not being, being his own kind of thinker, used the word in a psychological sense only. He didn't think that the universe papanchered, as it were. He didn't have opinions about that. But instead he thought, well, our minds do that. Our minds spread out and elaborate and proliferate, which means carry on generating more of their own thoughts. And this is a situation which is part of the problem. So let's have a look at this. Firstly, the discourse, and then we can look into the diagram. dependent on the I and form, and therefore also dependent on the ear and sounds, on the nose and smells, on the tongue and taste, on the body and tangibles, and the mind and mental objects, arises I consciousness and the other forms of consciousness. The coming together of the three is contact. With contact as condition arises feeling. So far, so familiar, I hope. Now it gets new. What one feels, that one perceives. The word perceives might be better translated recognises, or labels, names. What one recognises, perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one proliferates about. With what one proliferates about as the source, conceptual and perceptual proliferation assail one in terms of forms cognizable with the eye, sounds cognizable with the ear, and so on, in relation to past, present, and future. It's one of these extremely dense Dharma teachings which contains so much truth you could hardly explain it in weeks, but it's once you start to see it, you'll think, oh yeah, this is so useful. So starting from Vedana, we have, I start off a new page. So Vedana, your basic, now familiar experience of feeling. Constant information about pleasant, painful, neutral. What one feels, that one perceives. So this word for perception here is sanya. Perception or recognition. Perception just means identifying what's in our experience, yeah? Sofa, wall, light, sunshine, and so on. Perceptions are kind of quite a basic psychological function, but this word sanya really points to something slightly more complex, which is knowing what it is. So there's a blue form here. I perceive blue, but knowing it's a sofa, yeah, is a recognition of what this object is. And that's the sanya, recognition of Nayaka through his face and body, you know, recognition of Danny, or recognition of carpet or sunshine. This is sanya. And the idea here is that it's our feelings, our sense of pleasant, painful, neutral, which give us the information to get us interested in identifying things. It's a bit like what we were talking about with contact, I suppose, that there's an element of attention involved in making contact with particular objects in our experience. There's lots of stuff we don't notice because we're not attending to it. And likewise, there's a lot of stuff we don't label or recognise because it's not relevant. Our Vedana don't make it interesting. In another way, sanya we're simply identifying another part of our experience here. And just to, I don't know if this makes things more complicated or less, there's another discourse where the Buddha makes the point that contact and Vedana and sanya, that they're not really completely separate. They're not completely separate parts of our experience. They're three different aspects of our ordinary experience that kind of arise all together.
So by implication, you can't think about something until you've recognised it.
I think that's exactly it. So Steve's just made the point that he's asked, you've made the point, we can't think about something until we've recognised it. And that, I think that's an implication of this particular nidana chain. With feeling as condition arises, perceiving.
I'm wondering what goes on in the mind of an infant that's at the pre-recognition stage.
Yeah, yeah, what goes on in the mind of an infant. What do you think goes on in the mind of an infant, you who have children?
Recognizing you use the knowledge you do have to make a judgment about what it could be anyway, which is why when children are learning they get things mixed up because it kind of has lots of different features.
Right.
Similar features to something else.
Right. So children's thinking may not be detailed because what they perceive is based on what they already know, which might be quite literal.
Yeah.
Might not know too much yet.
Way, but it
yeah.
Might just be
yeah.
The skandhas could be just, you could understand the skandhas in a way, but deciding how a child finds feeding, finds the middle, actually. And what it finds pleasant and unpleasant goes towards, you know.
but a much less level of detail, yeah. Presumably. You know, like that's a good example of the infant finding the nipple. He's going to recognise the nipple when it finds it, I'm guessing, and think, oh, great, found it. Well, I won't exactly think that. But it's not a very sophisticated thought process. Is it really thinking? In fact, just simple Vedana.
For a baby, the first thing it does. This size was in its mouth.
Yeah.
So it's taste. So it's relating to taste all the time.
And yeah, yeah.
As it experiences its gathering and other things from its
mouth. So with that in mind, that you know, our ability to think, our ability to recognise and think actually does sort of develop through our infancy, I guess. What we're talking about here is like just how adults function, I suppose, with a fully developed capacity to think about things. I think this kind of psychology that the Buddha's doing is, once again, there isn't really any more to it than this. We've got the absolute bare bones of a psychological kind of theory. So there might be all sorts of problems with it if you know anything about modern psychology. And they're things that we need to sort of work through, I suppose. Because really the point here is what the Buddha's doing with the theory. It's a model for how we think about our experience and understand how dukkha arises. So I think, you know, how we relate to the theory can go from there. So contact and feeling and recognition all occurs in our experience pretty much at the same time, with that sort of appearance of a definite set of objects in our world. It's possible that thinking can start to take place. I think thinking here means something very straightforward, really, just pondering our experience. For instance, I was this morning, Anne was looking at the Vajraloka leaflet, yeah? And so it occurs to me that, you know, the contact with the Vajraloka leaflet might have led to certain feelings about when she was reading the content, the blurb, yeah, about this and that retreat. Or if it was me doing it, I might read about a Brahmi Vihara's retreat and think, that sounds interesting. Certain kind of recognition of, well, accompanied by the recognition of what these words mean, yeah? There's going to be some Vedana associated with this description. Then I might start thinking, can I do that? Can I fit that this into my program? Would I be able to do a two-week retreat? Based on thinking arises proliferation, papancha. Now, what this means in relation to thinking is, of course, the next step when one gets really interested in what one's thinking about, yeah? I think going on a Vajraloka retreat is hard to really proliferate too much. Perhaps if it was a holiday brochure, yeah, you might be thinking, you know, Bermuda, yeah, okay, the beaches are good, beer is cheap, whatever. And then the thought arises, who might I meet? Yeah, who else might go to Bermuda? It's the kind of place where I might meet such and such a type of person. This might occur. I've heard my friend went there last year and she had this amazing time with this person. It was quite something by the sound of it. Perhaps if I was to buy a new swimsuit, yeah, and to work out a bit, you know, something like that would happen with me, yeah, I should join up with a gym, shouldn't I? And actually swimsuits, there's a great one at Primark at the moment. Do you see what I mean? Is this, yeah, I'm making that up. I've never been to any. This is not an unusual experience, is it? In my book, I describe this, I think, you know, as reactive imagination. Don't know what you make of that. But, we've got minds that are brilliant at imagining. They're the most imaginative minds in the universe, possibly. But they can do this in a completely reactive mode. No problem solving. Just going from one thing to another, trying to get something. Now, the end result is what the Buddha calls conceptual and perceptual proliferation, which then he says they assail one in terms of past, present, and future. And so you see on my clever picture, I've just represented these terms in terms of arrows, and I've had them coming back on the basic nexus of present experience, consciousness, and, you know, of sense experience, because I don't know exactly how the Buddha would have represented it, but I think this is what he means. With all that stuff going on in my mind, yeah, I might end up thinking something like, in the past, because I didn't have the right swimsuit, that's why it didn't work out with such and such, yeah? What an idiot I was, not getting down Primark quicker. In the present, you know, I need to do some working out, and then I might start thinking, I'm really getting fat because I'm 48 and all the rest of it. So my present experience starts to get affected, yeah, by the content of my proliferation. Start to experience myself in certain ways in the past or in the future. Now, when I'm going to Bermuda, what if, you know, I've set myself up, haven't I, to have a certain kind of experience? Now, what if it doesn't happen? What if it's full of people who just aren't interested in me? For instance, they've got much better things to do than to get interested in my Primark swimsuit. Then I'm going to, my whole experience of being in Bermuda is going to be a real tense business, isn't it? I'm not going to be in the moment. So then I might worry about that because I realise that's what I'm doing. So my future holiday now becomes a real source of dukkha. So you know, my present experience is now getting lived through a whole set of ideas. Yeah. And this is conceptual proliferation assailing us. This is completely normal, isn't it? Completely normal, I think. But what I'd like to suggest is that, in a way, the energy for this kind of mode of what I've called reactive imagination, the energy is given by our underlying tendencies. You know, in a way, this is all just thinking, isn't it? And thinking is just this light as air, lighter than air kind of process, which could float away with a little breath of meditation. But actually, we don't experience it like that. We experience extremely strong, rigid tendencies in our thinking. And it strikes me, therefore, that we could understand the underlying tendencies as like the emotional component of this. Of this kind of proliferative process. This is a new thought I'm having, by the way, so I'm hoping you can see this as an experiment in understanding how these teachings on conditionality actually might be relevant for us.
What's a perceptual
proliferation? There's a complex compound in Pali. Can I even remember what it is now? Papancha Senya Sankar. There's a lot of scholarly dispute about what this actually means. And the best thing that people have come up is conceptual and perceptual proliferation. So it's a bit of a guess as to what it means, but I'd say it would be the proliferation of concepts, of ways of thinking, but also the proliferation of kind of tendencies to recognise things in certain ways. You know, I could go into Primark and say, yes, it's those ones. So there's, because they fit with my idea of what I think will do the trick in Bermuda. So that, it could be that that's a form of, yeah, very creative in a certain sense. This process you're talking about. Yeah.
Because the proliferation isn't conceptually abstract in the sense that it tends to form mind objects that we also label and put into the map, don't we?
Yeah, that's it. And that's a useful way to put it. It's not simply an abstract process of thought. It's the formation of quite vividly felt. In a way, we might actually create our own Vedana by creating these vividly felt ideas which we perceive, recognise.
They're worrying, isn't it? They have mind objects in their mind.
Yeah.
You know, they've got Vedana around it, and then if one realises it is only it's conceptual, perceptual proliferation, if you wanted to use that word.
Yeah. That's it. So, That's very useful. Anxiety and worry is like really clearly the outcome of a sort of perceptual, a proliferative process, isn't it? But that doesn't mean that the Vedana and the Sanya don't exist. Of course, they exist very vividly, don't they? And we worry about them. So, but it's worth noticing that the process that's led to them all.
It makes me think of like when it becomes the level of a disease, like I'm thinking of like anorexia or body dysmorphia.
Yeah.
But you mentioned the gym, so just the way like your perception is through a certain kind of lens, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you think that there's this girl who goes to my gym who's obviously very, very ill.
Yeah.
And she must see herself in a certain way.
Yeah.
And you can see how that's gonna go in a little circle, and so her Vedana to do with her body experience and her recognition of her body experience is going to be coloured by her propensity to do with her, what it means, and round and round she goes.
Yeah, anorexia is a great example, but it's a very unfortunate example of the power of proliferation, isn't it? Because I believe that people who suffer from it, they stop being able to make a judgment about what's healthy. Is that right?
It's also interesting, maybe, for instance, you have a tendency, it's just this underlying tendency to worry and anxiety, it's kind of
yeah.
Particular mind object.
Yeah. And then it kind of goes on from there. So you can see the value of this model, but you can see how this model works. Now its value is seeing how the proliferation process starts from Vedana. There's this constant Vedana accompanying all our experience. If we can bear with Vedana, notice Vedana, it's possible to see the proliferation process as for what it is, as not being... It's as it were a secondary reality, if that makes sense. I mean, of course, that doesn't mean it's unreal. You know, someone with anorexia really dies, unfortunately. But it's a secondary reality in the sense that it's based upon something else. And now the Buddha is described as nishprapancha, nipapancha, not having any papancha.
Can you say about the difference between papancha and the thinking?
Oh, right. So before we get on to Buddha's and there being nipapancha, no, because that's what's the difference in thinking and proliferation. Is that right? Well, to give you an example of the difference, that it's said that thinking is one of the jhana factors for first jhana, yeah? So in order to attain to the first level of meditative absorption, one needs to be thinking about the meditation object, pondering it, thinking what it's like. Meditative absorption can have this element of thought in it. So thinking in itself can be a perfectly healthy creative activity. But I suppose if it turns into proliferation, it gets obsessive. I suppose that's another translation of proliferation as obsession, which is quite nice, I think. Thinking can become, as it were, caught up in its own creations. Perhaps that's where the underlying tendencies get involved. And no longer being a creative function becomes something that's a slave of a bigger process. I'm sure that the Buddha thought about things just like we do, perhaps a lot more clearly. But I don't think that this process is all bad, as it were. But the Buddha didn't end up proliferating.
Do you know what the Pali word is that's used in the sutta?
For thinking. Vitakkheti. Which doesn't really help a lot, because it just means thinking. It's a very unclear word, you know, exactly what it means. Or I say unclear, it's just like the English thinking. It's got a kind of wide range of meanings. So to say the Buddha doesn't have proliferation, nipapancha, means for enlightened beings there's Vedana, there's going to be a certain degree of recognition, maybe sometimes thinking, but it's going to be optional, and that's it. That's it, the rest doesn't happen. So this is why, you know, when Buddhas are said to be not caught up in the past and the future, that they're not having thoughts about the past and the future. They're not caught up in trains of thoughts about past and future, because there isn't a proliferative process going on.
In the 12 Nidana image.
Wheel of Life, you mean?
Yeah, the Wheel of Life.
Yes.
And it is just imagery. I keep trying to remind myself of that.
Yeah.
Craving follows Vedana.
It does.
So, does that mean that is just shorthand, that jump from Vedana to craving, is that just shorthand for, in fact, what is going on is this?
Very interesting question.
Somehow thinking.
This is a really fascinating question. So is this link, feeling leads to craving, a kind of shorthand? I think it must be, because for two reasons. Firstly, because it's really obvious that on condition of Vedana, we do a lot of aversion and rejection, not just craving. Yeah. And the second reason is that word tanha doesn't really mean craving. It means this very sort of broad wanting or longing. I think it's a kind of word that the Buddha's using, dropping in, to say whatever leads to processes of characterized by wanting and longing.
So when it says wanting, because obviously it's always framed, kind of framed in the positive, in the sense that we think of craving as wanting more, but
yeah.
Can we think of it as wanting more or less?
Yeah. I mean,
I have a reaction towards or away from Vedana. Right, so craving more or less, or whichever pole it's on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in modern psychology, they're just called aversive desires. Yeah. Sorry, that might be a bit of a leap, but you can talk about desire, which is aversive. You know, I really want to be away from such and such place. It's a desire, but it's a desire to not have a certain experience. But the Buddha doesn't actually define tanha like that. It makes sense to do so. But that leaves us with the kind of question that Anne's raised. Could tanha be a kind of shorthand for that kind of, for a kind of aversive desire? Could it also suggest this whole business of the underlying tendencies kicking in? And could it also suggest this proliferation process? That leads us to suppose, and I think this is a useful way to look at the 12 nidanas. It's a kind of mnemonic, it's a memorable list. You could learn the 12 nidanas, but you could know that each link, as it were, can unfold into a more detailed model of what's happening in your experience, and give you a kind of, this gives you a memorable way in an oral culture to think about the Buddha's teaching about experience. This allows us to see the 12 nidanas in a much less literal way. I'm going to finish really soon. I just want to mention the 5 skandhas, as this afternoon we're going to have a reflection, meditative reflection based on this teaching. A very common way in which the Buddha analysed our experience is into the 5 constituents, the 5 khandhas, or in Tri Ratna we usually use the Sanskrit skandhas. And this is, it's a very easy to handle list, I think. Just 5 things. You can count them on a hand. It's not too difficult to memorise. And they sort of sum up a lot of what we've been talking about. And they sum it up in a particular way. Because the Buddha always recommended that you analyse your own experience in this fivefold way. So instead of thinking of yourself as me, this person who is characterised by this ego, this set of ambitions, this past and so on, you could analyse your experience in this way, and this will have a liberating effect. Firstly, there's form, our material body. There's feeling, Vedana, which depend, of course, entirely on our body and its sense organs. There's perception or recognition, Sanya. There's the formations, the Sankara, the dispositions and tendencies and habits that, as it were, keep our experience rolling along. And then finally, there's Vijnana, consciousness, the subjective awareness which gives us, through which we're able to know about our experience. So I've dropped them in there, probably a bit too much extra information, and we'll stop there, but we've set us up for Nayaka's led meditation this afternoon now. Thanks very much.